Guys, ZDogg MD, Dr. Angelo DiLullo, anesthesiologist and awakening dude. So Angelo and I have done a series now about awakening, spiritual awakening, finding your true nature, identity, unfiltered reality. There's a series of linked to it all here. What I want to talk about now, though, is something that may trigger some people. We're going to talk about, because we're going to go deep on it. So awakening is just the first sort of movement. It's a mm-hmm. profound movement, but the first movement in an unfolding that continues. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk now about the continuing of that unfolding. Mm-hmm. We talked before about you awaken, you realize the identity is not this me. It's kind of unbound consciousness. And then there's that feeling of emotion and trying to integrate emotion afterwards, and shadow work, and the sort of stuff that's been repressed forever now comes to the surface, and working to integrate that. There's even more than that in mm-hmm. the unfolding, and it gets kind of awesome mm-hmm. and also a little bit like, oh, that's the nature of reality? Oh, so over to you, Doc, because mm-hmm. This is where I just sit like this and go, uh-huh, tell me more.
So this actually is one of the major areas of interest I had in writing the book, but I got to 130,000 words and I was like, I didn't quite get to that part. Yeah, I touched into it many times with the approaches and techniques that are useful after awakening. And in the stages of awakening chapter, I definitely point to it with analogies, the pond analogy and that sort of thing. So these are the shifts that occur later on, but that's a very, metaphorical way of talking about it, but it also can give you the experience of it for sure, aspects of it. But I didn't actually include, and this is the next book I'm going to write, I didn't actually include like, here's the exact fixation, here's how to address it, and here's the next one, and here's how to address it, and then here's the next one. Because there's a handful of things that need to be addressed if this process is to continue itself to completion, is at least as far as the individual is concerned. Mm. It's never complete. This process is never complete, but there is a certain very distinct finality when it comes to the experience of being an individual apart from a world, navigating that world, struggling with that world. That actually can come to an end, and it does. So that's what we're going to talk about. Now, again, you mentioned awakening is this very transformative, very powerful. It will be the biggest thing that's ever happened to you in your life. To go through it is an amazing, tremendous release of suffering and emotion and these sorts of things. And the other side of it is deeply, deeply peaceful in a way that you kind of forgot was even possible since maybe very early childhood. And then that's kind of the honeymoon period. And you, as I've said before, you sort of feel enlightened, you know, or you're not going to think about yourself as enlightened, but the experience is. It is kind of like when I talk to somebody who has just gone through the awakening, they just feel enlightened to me. Like that's how when I interact with them, I can interact in a very, very direct way, which is lovely. And it's just so fluid. And yet I can still see their conditioning is there and it's starting to creep back in here and there. Mm. And I try to point it out, but I know that at some point they're going to have to really just dive into it anyway. But the conditioning is basically a mass of resistance patterns. And a lot of it has to do with repressed emotions and it has to do with distorting beliefs. We've touched on some of this stuff as well in the previous program. So I'm going to go beyond that and now and talk about, okay, well, what the heck happens after that, right? So I can't give you statistics on this, but I can tell you of the people who go through awakening, which this is happening more and more and more. Some people have gone through spontaneous awakening. Some people have intentionally moved through this process. But of the people who've gone through awakening, I think probably a good number of people kind of get sort of lost in this sort of spiritual no person's land after for a while. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because it can be a really confusing time, because it's kind of like once you taste unfiltered reality, you kind of see that everything is unfiltered reality, and yet the conditioning can still be there. And sometimes it's worse for a while, or it's more intense, or the emotions are more intense, or your bad habits are more intense and they're just in your face and you can't ignore them. But you're like, do I ignore them? Do I just continue to be kind of a jerk? And that's just how life is because everything's unfiltered reality anyway. Or is there a way to actually investigate it more closely? Or is there something else I need to look at that I'm totally missing that's still operating here And some people sense that no, there's definitely something here that needs to continue to be addressed. Other people seem to not really sense it. And at some point they might catch on it once they really get tired of suffering, even after awakening. Suffering is less, I would say. It's different kind of suffering, but if your discernment and authenticity are intact, you'll still realize, no, there's still some suffering here. There's still something going on. There's still resistance. And I'm still struggling somehow, even though it's kind of episodic and I don't really know why or how. So if you're able to start to pick that up, and you find good pointers, you find good teachers, really people who can really point beyond that, then you can proceed through these other sort of fixation stages and untie these deeper dualistic knots. I always like to say when I talk about this type of subject that it doesn't happen the same way for everyone. It doesn't happen in the same order for everyone. And they may not even interpret the nature of these shifts in the same way. Some people will talk about these things very differently. But there are, my opinion and my experience and the opinion of other people I know who know this material pretty well, that they would say there's pretty consistent and predictable fixations that are still occurring often after awakening that can be so subtle you can totally overlook them. But if you address them, the experiential insight will deepen very, very profoundly. Okay. And so what are these fixations? And you could also say, even though this is probably a little less accurate way of saying it, that each one of these fixations that gets addressed results in, like, you could almost say like another stage of realization. But even though I have a chapter called stages, I'm always a little cautious with that term because it almost sounds like you're building something, but it's not like that. It's a subtractive process. But within these fixations are untied, there's a very clear, obvious shift into a more fundamentally, obviously true and real reality. And they have different qualities to them, that these types of movements and shifts. Okay. Does that make sense?
It makes as much sense as it can.
Okay. So the other disclaimer I want to kind of put out there with this is we've been talking about something that's hard to talk about for the last 2 days, which is awakening and realization and awareness and all that, right? It's paradoxical. The language doesn't quite work, but it's all an intuitive thing. You either get it or you don't, or maybe you get it later, but it's really intuitive. It's not about the language or the words. It's not a shift in paradigm. It's not a way of thinking. It's totally non-conceptual. It's beyond concept. So we've already been working with that struggling type language kind of thing. And this is the nature of talking about this stuff. I'm talking about that which cannot be talked about ever, right? Now, when we're talking about later stage realization, it's even worse because it's more subtle. I'm talking about things that are so subtle that to try to apprehend these conceptually is a complete waste of time. You can make a mental model of them and you might even hinder yourself because it's just, they're so subtle and they're nothing to do with concept. They're to do with more like what we were talking about in the last video you and I shot about the attention, where we were investigating the direct nature of the sense world. It's very subtle stuff, but if the pointing and your technique and your approach is gentle enough, you start to really discern, oh yeah, it's subtle, but it's also quite profound that a minute ago that was a glass over there and now I'm kind of feeling it like everywhere. What is that about, right? It's that kind of subtlety. So language really fails here, and the farther this realization goes, the more it fails. But there are still pointers that work. There are inquiries that work for this stuff, okay? And there there are two aspects to what allows you to address these dualistic knots or these fixations, these deep, very deep-seated, fundamental to our processing perceptual filters. There's two approaches, but at this subtle level, they become the same approach. And this is, again, we're talking paradoxically, but it feels like this. And perhaps in Buddhism, you could say this is the middle way, or at least one iteration of what that could mean. And that is, there's this aspect of surrender that has to be there, like surrender, like the kind of surrender where you can't even do it. You need to be surrendered. it's that life is surrendering you to the natural process of, you know, disintegration into the radical integration of reality, or how, no way to talk about this, but so there's this surrendering aspect that's very critical here. And if you tend too much on the other side, you miss that aspect, this can be challenging because you'll introduce too much struggle. The other side is intention. Okay. Surrender is a acquiescent movement. Whatever this is, I'm not really sure what it is. It's unknowable, but I can feel it coming forth, carrying me forward, carrying this realization forward and deeper into itself. And I'm just willing to trust it the best I know how in the moment. And I can feel into it. I can intuit what it is. And I'm allowing myself to align with it. It's that kind of surrendering. Yeah. Mm. And sometimes it's a surrender of, I have no choice and this is just going. And life is forcing me to experience certain things, to untie things in myself that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. You start to really have this reverence for life itself, for the genius of this presence itself. Mm. It seems to have this intelligence. Mm. So that's the surrender aspect. But the other aspect is intention. And intention just means your own intention to inhabit truth beyond what you think it is right here. Always being willing to just see a little deeper into truth, into living truth. It's a little more maybe incisive. It's the willingness to actually do some inquiry if you have to. Yeah. And so there's a balance between those two, that surrender and intention, that really comes into play here. And it's an aliveness. There's an aliveness in your practice, your practiceless practice. Mm. And with that as the guiding movement, you can start to address these fixations. Mm. So what are they? So one of them has to do with the what we experience as the physical world of time and space, specifically space. And that is the sense that the world is dualistic, not even in a thinking way, not in a conscious thought-based way, but an actual physical experience of that's over here and I'm over here. So when that dualistic knot is untied, you can't even experience that anymore. You can't experience that distance anymore. There can be a thought about it, but there's no identity in that. The non-distanced or center everywhere or here and there at the same time experience is very clearly seen to be just the way it is, and there's no way it could be other.
Mm.
Yeah. And it's like sound sounding, sense sensing, even thought thinking. It's just a phenomenon coming into being and disappearing into nothingness.
With no location.
Yeah, locationality is seen at this point to have always been a thought.
A thought. Mm-hmm. So location is that overlay we talked about in our attention piece of like, here's distance and here's the sensation.
Right. So with any sensation or any experience you're having right now, if you recognize there's no such thing as anywhere else because the presence has become so clear, right? There's just that sensation, literally, or just that visual experience. When that becomes very, very clear, it's also very clear there's nowhere else. And when there's nowhere else, there's also no here. And so there's no differentiation between here and everywhere else. Mm. So space, spacing, the activity of creating seeming space in your perceptual experience is gone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. It's a trip. Like, it's really wild. But it's also just the way it is, and you actually get used to it.
And you can
actually bump into things sometimes.
Really? I was going to say, can you function? Like,
You definitely can, for sure. Yeah. But when you first start to experience it, or if it comes on very strong, very quickly for some people, they literally like have to be careful how they move around and drive and stuff at first until you get used to it, because it is very different.
Wow.
Now, again, the mind can still perceive the world in that visual way of you're over there and I'm over here.
By creating the
but
thought.
But instinctually, it's not real. You don't actually experience that as real. So the world of thought becomes very, I don't know how to say it. I don't want to say detached. All of the referencing of the world of thought for what's real goes away.
Ah, so thought can exist, but it doesn't become the basis of reference for reality. It
doesn't say anything about anything but itself.
Wow.
Again, thoughts reflecting thoughts reflecting thoughts. Yeah. There's nothing to it, though. No substance.
Yeah.
So that's one of the disentanglements, we could say. And that really, it's very much a perceptual thing. It makes the world look different, you could say. Feel different, sound different. But it's almost, impersonal. It's a sort of an impersonal type of thing, because it's just like, oh, I was looking through the senses one way, and all of a sudden I'm looking through the senses in a very, very different way. Mm. But you're not looking through the senses. The senses just are very clearly not like it seemed before, the sense world. And then it's like, well, is it even a sense? Because who's sensing it? There's no one sensing it. The sensing is in the sense. So it becomes completely impossible to talk about, but it's intimate, very obvious. It's really wonderful in a certain natural way. That's just how it is, you know?
So to get to that subtractive state, mm-hmm. subtracting that filter of mm-hmm. distance, you are inhabiting this combination simultaneously of surrender and intentionality that you talked about earlier. That's necessary.
That's just where I would orient somebody
yeah.
to start to work through these things. Yeah. Because if you're too hands-on, like I'm going to force this perception to be like this other perception or remove this filter in some conceptual way you're thinking about.
You're doing something.
You might be actually putting a little too much effort into it. Mm. If you're too much towards the surrender side, you can kind of be like, oh, well, everything is just the way it is and there's nothing to change or move or fix or whatever. And mm-hmm. it'll just kind of do what it needs to do. But then you can kind of sort of ignore things sometimes. So there's this magic place between those two ways of approaching realization or your own practice or process. Mm-hmm. So that's just, and that's not something you even have to really worry about. I was just putting it out there like, this is helpful.
Right.
Some of this can just happen completely spontaneously.
Spontaneously, yeah.
Totally.
But you're saying it by having those sort of conditions, it's more likely to.
Yeah. I think that addresses the intense fixation one direction or the other. Mm-hmm. Again, one of them that's like way too hands on, too intellectual, too mm-hmm. like I know how this is going to go. I'm going to make it go that way because I'm picturing the way it should go mm-hmm. and comparing my experience to how you know. Mm-hmm. And then you're just kind of keep putting mind in the way almost. On the other side, it's like this. It's almost like a bit of a laziness, like it's good enough, and it's very clear, things are very clear, and I don't have to think about anything. I'm just it's just life. I'm just going to go with life how it is, and it's great. And there's nothing more to do. There's nothing to do. There's nothing to address. There's no one to address it. You can get into this weird place with that. So if you kind of find this place between the two, you realize, okay, if I'm deeply honest with myself, there's more to address. There's more that could be addressed. Mm. And that's kind of the intention or truth side. And another part of you just knows, and there's not a damn thing I can do to address that. I have to trust life to really show me how this works. Mm. Yeah. And you just find this place of, oh yeah, it's like surrendering itself almost as the practice, the practice practicing itself. Yeah. Anyway, so that can be applied to any of these sort of fixations that we're talking about. Mm. So one of them is that subject-object experience that we're creating with the mind all the time. We're not creating it. It's not even there. But the illusion of it is perpetuated by the way thoughts reflect one another.
Right. Yeah. So again, prime mover is thought.
Mm-hmm.
Thought.
It's the relationship with thought.
The relationship with thought.
Thought's not a bad guy.
Right.
As I think I said in one of these shows, you don't want to push it away. You don't want to make it the bad guy. You don't want to sit down and meditate and picture yourself with a sword cutting thoughts and slashing them. And some people actually have said that to me, like, oh yeah, I pictured it. Like I'm hitting the thoughts and pushing them out of the way. And like, it's not like that. It's more like investigate the nature of your relationship with thought.
Yeah.
And at some point identity falls out of thought. And then it actually seems like it's identity's in being. But as we move through this, what we're talking about, mm-hmm. identity itself as a construct completely goes away.
Oh, that is wild.
So it's not like identity is unbound being or unbound consciousness. There's just no identity.
So
because identity also suggest separation.
Right.
Because if there's identity, then my identity can't be your identity, or what's the point in talking about identity?
Can I ask a question? So is that why they call it non-dual instead of everything is one?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because even everything is one implies an identity mm-hmm. as one?
Yeah, like a singularity.
It's
not, I don't really think that neither of these terms are exact. There's no term to talk about what we're talking about.
Got it.
But you can sense into it and you can wake up to it. And you can also taste it through those exercises we talked about with the attention, right?
Attention, yeah.
There's no exact way to talk about it. Mm. But to me, and other people may have a different experience of this for sure. But to me, to call it a singularity, it's almost sends a picture in your mind of like one thing or one place or one point. Mm. But there's no points, which means there's every point, which means there's no self or other or subject or object. Or that's why intimacy to me just ends up being the right word, because right. even that's not perfect. But it's not so much a singularity. It's just more of what it's not.
Right.
It's not a subject-object experience.
Right. Non-dual.
Yeah. And when that goes away, you're like, oh, geez, it's amazing how fixating that was. And at the same time, it's amazing that I believed it for so long. How did I see this world in that way? Well, you kind of know the answer to that, because if you were there seeing the world in that way, then there was a perception of a self apart and a world over there. But experientially, it's just so obvious.
Yeah.
Which is odd.
Yeah. And so that's
a lot of this stuff is like that. It's like, oh, of course it's like that.
And this is the part of the progression where you really do start speaking in paradox, because because reality is.
Language is based on separation.
Separation.
Right? What is language for? It's like, you know, I don't know when they started developing language, but like cave person days where they're like, hey, I clubbed a, you know, Tyrannosaurus over there, 60 meters from the tree. It's over there. You know, it's like language is designed to describe space and time to people, right?
Yeah.
That's how language
to
is.
To people, meaning not you. Yeah.
Yeah. Just the fact that I even said this in the thoughts chapter or somewhere in there, I said, even the fact that you're using language to talk to somebody already assumes. I'm conveying information
that's
to
right.
you.
That's right.
Or I'm bonding with you through language or
that's
something.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Because even we is not the correct term. We implies an us. Right. It gets very sticky to talk about. You're right. Yeah. Even in a conceptual way, you can't do it. Actually, I've never thought of it this way. Like the fact that paradox means if you're speaking in language, language is how you're going to convey something. That language will contain paradox, because language cannot simultaneously explain actual reality when there's only this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it gets more paradoxical the point where it's.
Please keep going.
Everything and nothing. And that's like, well, that makes zero sense to the mind. It sounds like blah, blah, blah. It sounds like blah, 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 blah. Like it makes no sense.
Like an alien talking
to you. And yet, when you experience what it means that everything is no thing, it's the most obvious thing in the world. It's not even special. It's just so simple. Hmm. So the paradoxical stuff, yeah, and language, it just lends itself to thought. It lends itself to a thought structure,
mm-hmm.
and thought and language are very, very intimately tied, right?
Right. You know? Dualistic structures, mm-hmm. and you know what's interesting is if you really like that's just what you're pointing at. That sounds so wild to the mind, mm-hmm. is just how reality is right now, mm-hmm. for everything.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't see it because of the fixative structures that you describe.
That's right. That's why there's no unenlightened people.
Because they're
everybody is experiencing this.
Right now.
Mm-hmm.
Only
and
now.
And they're experiencing a brain that's interpreting it as something different than it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just thought action. It's just thought activity. It doesn't even.
Brain is a
that's
thought.
That's why in a sense it doesn't even matter that people are awake or asleep. It doesn't. Because the reality is what it is.
Yeah.
And it's right there for you when you're ready to wake up to
actually,
it.
Can we dig into that piece for a second? Because this is interesting. It doesn't really matter that people are awake or asleep, yet we talk about ending suffering in this lifetime as a desirable goal. Are those two statements incompatible?
Well, the thing about this that's nice is that I in this type of movement and what we're talking about, I find that people can really trust their intuition here. If you hear that and you say, well, I'm not suffering, I have a great life and I love what I do and that's what I'm, you know, so I don't even know why I would do any of this. And then I would say to them, that's exactly right.
Mm.
It's totally fine. I'm not going to tell you you're suffering. If you're not, great.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So as I said one other time in this interview series, I would say it like this. There are people who are waking up, but there's no one who's asleep. I don't see the world as like full of asleep people or anything like that. But when the awakening process starts happening, it's obvious to the person it's happening.
To the person,
you can't ignore it, right? Yeah. You're like, oh, I got to do this. I got to address this. It's terrifying, but I got to address it. It's wild and exciting, but I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I know I'm going to do it, right? Mm. Has that flavor to it. Mm. So if you have that flavor, well, then why not talk about this? I'm more than happy to talk about it if that's real for you. Mm. That's all this comes down to. There's no moral imperative at all for any of this, mm-hmm. for anyone. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That bears repeating. I mean, we've said it in almost every episode. Yeah.
But it's important because people pick this stuff up and they haven't even had an awakening, but they start to sense it. And then it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go tell all my friends, you need to wake up. I know what your problem is. You're not awake.
You're asleep. Yeah.
I'm not awake either yet, but I'm going to be. I know what your problem is. I can help you. Here, read this book or whatever. And it just happens. Like, we just get these weird spiritual ego things and stuff. Yeah, yeah. And
Zen stink.
Zen stink. Some people go through it in a really intense way. Other people, it's a very mild version, but it's just, and it's sometimes it's well-intentioned. We want to help people we care about. And if you feel suffering in them and you feel suffering in yourself, you're like, oh, you need this. And it's, but often we're actually projecting. Like, we're saying, you need this. And it's like, no, I need this. Mm. Like, just, you know, do the Confucius thing. Like, don't complain about your neighbor's roof with snow on it until you've cleaned the snow off your own roof.
Right.
Or and then by the time you really do that, you won't complain about your neighbor's roof anymore.
So we're at, are we at the last fixation? Where are we at?
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Gosh, come on. More.
Keep going.
There's more.
Tell me more.
So, this part of things gets into one of the two or three potentially really triggering aspects of this. Mm-hmm. One of them we kind of touched on before, which is like that no agency or the illusion of agency, at least in the way we think about it, and seeing through that. Mm-hmm. You don't go and get rid of that and say there's no such thing as agency, even though it seems like there is. That's not what happens. It suddenly falls away and you're like, whoa, I didn't, God, what? That made me feel so much struggle all that time, and I was so certain I wanted it. I was defending it, and now it's such a relief to be without it. So that sense of agency. That's one thing. But the other one is no self. Dun, dun, dun. Experience of no self. That sounds terrible, like you're going to disappear out of reality or something, right? But no self just simply means there's no self apart from anything else. There's no self-suffering. There's no individual, distinct, threatenable self that comes into being and goes out of being. Again, everything gets so close, so intimate, so non-dual that you really start to see there's no thing that's an abiding separate self. It's something like there's just reality or just experience, just vivid, alive experience. And so again, that can be really triggering to some people because it sounds... Sometimes it's counterintuitive, like, well, I know there's a self. There's obviously a self. And if that's your experience, that's great. In fact, I might even tell you, just rest in that sense of what you are. Just rest right in it. That's great. Just rest there. You know, and that can actually lead people into awakening. Mm. But this paradoxical thing, again, happens after awakening where you can have a massive, very deeply held sense of I am that happens after awakening or through awakening, pure sense I am, pure being. And then all of a sudden it starts to thin itself out and you start to recognize, oh, even that was a thought, right? Like Nisargadatta, the book you have on your table.
Yeah.
Somewhere he says, if you regress properly, the I am thought will disappear. And that's exactly what happens. It just disappears like a thought. You just go, oh, I don't need that. That was a thought. It was a belief. It was a belief. And then all of a sudden things just look very, very different. It's not scary. It's not. It's actually very, very freeing. So these later stages actually kind of culminate in the experience of no self. No self, I could say no self apart. It's less triggering and it's more true, actually.
More true. Yeah.
But what does self mean when there's only this
stuff?
Yeah. There's only this. It is kind of one thing, but that one thing isn't in one place. So I can't call it one thing as opposed to other things. So then what does self mean anymore? What does other mean anymore? So if there's no self, there's no other. There's no inside, there's no outside. But all those dualistic terms in language, you start to see they were all illusions. There's just this. There's just this. There's nothing you can say about it, but you can fully experience it as it. Yeah. With no one experiencing it, you just kind of collapse into it, you could say. Anyway, so again, very difficult to talk about this stuff accurately, but I will say, it turns out to be okay. It turns out to be really, really good news.
I don't know why, but I feel that way. Mm-hmm. Like, I know how it could be terrifying.
There are times when it can be, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, yeah.
It can be almost disappointing when you realize all this spiritual journey has not been about me. I thought it was about me the whole time. And you're just like, shit, it's not really about me.
It's just not about me.
It's just about what it's about. And it's not about anything. It's just this. Man. Right.
Yeah.
So again, we're talking about the later stage stuff. And then there's this other aspect that often sticks around for a long time. And sometimes it's really intense and sometimes it's more subtle, but it's there and it has to be addressed. And that's the relational self. It's the tendency to experience life as some kind of external world that's really your internal world. It's your mind doing this, but it makes it look like this external world where you're always managing everything, trying to get it right for yourself so that you can do okay, or even get it right for others. You might have yourself convinced you're a compassionate person and you're trying to get everything right so you can be more compassionate for the world and all this.
Every nurse but it, ever. Yeah.
But the truth.
Yeah. I mean, they really are.
But anyway, the point is like, there's so much struggle in that that's intrinsic to it. And you don't realize that. It feels so much like what you are to struggle with life that it's, you can't imagine not doing it. But you can see that it's unnecessary through inquiry. You can start to recognize that there's no need to hold that relational matrix together all the time. One way of saying it is you learn to really just trust the moment so fully that I don't have to preconceive what to do, how to react, how to respond, how to give more, take more from this moment. It's just this. And it starts to feel really... It feels like equanimity. It is equanimity, is what this is. It's another degree of peace. It's natural enjoyment, but not a big deal. Again, it's very simple.
So you told
me innocent.
You told me something this morning when you walked up and you'd parked in my garage and you said, "You know, I was walking through your garage and it used to be like you'd spend time." You'd just be like, "Oh, I got to get through this garage because there's nothing going on here. I need to get to point B." And instead, you said something quite remarkable, which is, so this is what it feels like to be in love with a garage.
With the basement of the garage.
Basement of the garage. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that for us through this?
Well, I was just walking to the elevator and the thought came of, in the past, I would have thought of this as, I'm just walking through this place that is unimportant. The garage is usually an unimportant, it's a practicality. And it's just like the thing you have to get through to get to the next thing that's more important, right? Whatever. I see this a lot with people who feel really impatient, like at the grocery checkout, right? Everyone's just like, in their mind, they're picturing the dinner they're going to cook when they get home or the glass of wine or whatever. And it's natural. We all do this kind of thing, right? Humans do this. But if you really look at what's happening, we're rejecting that experience right then. We're like, this isn't a real experience. The real one's the one I'm imagining in my mind when I get home. And then somehow when you get home, you can't actually be present there either because your mind is so used to not being present.
It's already somewhere else.
Yeah. So this was kind of a remarkable reflection on how I used to process reality. And as I was walking through the garage, like I just feel love. Like I feel intimacy for the garage itself. But it's not a garage. That's why. It's everything. It's you. It's me. It's what all this is made out of. It's just, and I was like, the feeling of it, the sensation of the foot striking the cement, the visual experience of that cement in a non-dualistic way. It's in the body. It's out of the body. It's just alive. It's just aliveness garaging. And what a wonderful experience. I don't need anything outside of this. I don't need anything more than this. I don't need to get anywhere. There's nowhere to get. There's only this. And it's wonderful. Yeah.
Ah.
So you could say that's an example of the mundane coming alive.
Becoming alive.
Yeah, or the mundane just demonstrating to you that presence is immediately available all the time and in depths that are unfathomable if you're willing to look into it one way or another. And willing to let go, willing to examine beliefs, all the things we've been talking about. Yeah. And then there's more.
There's more. Keep going.
There are a couple other things. I'll mention one. I think we're getting moving forward on time. But so one other aspect to this that's important is that when I mentioned no self, again, if you think about that and think something's going to disappear that's here right now that feels like myself, you're not going to be able to imagine what it is that disappears. It's not like that. It's just a sudden lightness. and a holy, whoa, what is that about? You know? And also at the very same time, it's like, yeah, it's exactly like this. It couldn't be anything other than this. Mm. And it's a flow state that's just always there, sort of something like that.
Mm.
Okay. Anyway, that what it is that goes away, what it is that ceases activity, which I would call, I'm going to call the self for this way of talking. What it is that ceases activity is kind of made up of a few different aspects that are intertwined in a way that feels so intimate that they feel like one thing, but you can actually sort of pick them apart a little bit in these fixations. I've already talked about two of them. A third one that's prominent and probably one of the slipperiest, it's one of the most subtle, easy to overlook, is this, it's this tendency and operation of the mind to frame reality.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, at first it's framing your reality, then it's framing whatever reality you perceive when you start to wake up, whether it's consciousness or awareness, but it's a framing that goes on. So one analogy I've made in something I wrote that I'll put in the next book is you could say in one sense, the most fundamental movement of the thinking mind is to take a picture of reality. Go click, this is how it is. This is how it is. Click, this is how it is. It always wants to know how it is, right? In the most fundamental sense, because if the mind doesn't know how it is, how this is, how I am, it's done. It has nothing more it can do. So the most fundamental movement of that mind-identified egoic seeking mind or whatever is to take a picture. I can't even start seeking until I look and see, oh, this is how it is.
Mm.
And then I can seek and go, and this is how it could be with another thought, right? So this is how it is. Click. This is how it is. It's like taking pictures. When you inquire into this fixation, this tendency to form frames of reality, to extrapolate a certain kind of reality, a universal reality, an infinite reality, any kind of reality at all, any specific way that things are, it can stop happening. And it's a whole other degree of freedom where it's like, there's no defining way that reality is. It's too free to be defined at all, in any way at all. It's not a certain way. And then it's really weird because it's like, what was making it seem like it needed to be a certain way? Right? This can be kind of like, at the same time, totally mind-blowing and totally like, duh. How did I ever think things had to be a certain way? Because everything's changing all the time. Of course, everything's always in flux to the point where there's no things.
Okay. So when I read that in your book, it was one of the advanced stages in chapter 10 of like, oh, by the way, there's no way that things are. You just go, and
yeah.
You describing it now, I actually am getting a sense of what you're saying. Now, again, it's can I run this by you? So let me just see if I understand this, what you were trying to communicate. I know I won't do it quite justice. The mind takes an integrative mind moment of what is reality and goes, it's this way, and kind of shows it to you almost in a delayed fashion, almost in a slightly non-immediate fashion, and says reality, here, this is what reality is, this cohesive thing that has this connection. But what you're saying is when that drops away, you realize there's no way that reality is. It just...
You can't even open your mouth to say a word about it.
Yeah, it's just language stops.
Yeah, so that's not a bad way of saying it. I'm going to adjust it a little bit.
Yeah.
When you say you're looking at reality and it's saying this is the way it is, you actually put your hands in front. That's still looking from a subject-object confirmation in consciousness.
That's collapsed already.
So yeah, that's gone.
Yeah.
And it's actually not out here that's saying this is the way things are. It's the sense back here of the most fundamental sense of you.
Uh-huh.
It's the one looking through those eyes, looking at reality. This is a very, very fundamental movement of mind. It's so easy to, you can't actually look directly at it because you're looking from it. Uh-huh. So it's very subtle and tricky to inquire into this.
Mm.
Can you sense that?
Yeah.
It's that which is looking out into the world in the most fundamental, subtle way. Into the mind, into the senses, it feels like it has to be there until it's not. So that's another important key to this. Maybe it's a bit of like a triad of what creates the sense of self. There's other ways to talk about all this stuff as well.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It just shocks me that people wouldn't want this. You know, that's just me.
At some point, it becomes not wantable because who's going to want it?
Who's going to want it?
Yeah, it's so paradoxical.
This is nothing the way things are. There's no one to notice that. And I'm in love with a parking lot. Biatch.
Yeah,
it's right. It's just amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there any more or is that?
There are more subtleties I could talk about, but that's the gist
of it. That's the gist of it. That's
the big, and there's ways to address each one of those.
So when people have their awakening.
It's all basically inquiry.
Inquiry.
Pretty much. Or just a certain kind of surrender or, you know, some people have a real devotional surrender to this.
Explain that.
I'm not really that kind of person necessarily, but just they have a feeling of like devotion. It's almost like a movement of love for the process itself or I don't know what. And that devotional, it's a very surrendered type of movement. And that carries people through this as well. But at some point it's just, there's no one to do anything anymore. So it gets very tricky to, you can't even really teach anything or point anything because there's nothing to do that anymore. So it's just a matter of what's happening now. And it carries itself forward is one way of saying it. Or it carries itself deeper into itself.
Wow.
And your job is to just be willing to be really alert and discerning in what you notice. And if you notice any way that you're getting in its way, be willing to relax that a little bit. So your job is to get out of its way at some point. But it gets, again, subtle because it's, who's even going
to
do that?
Yeah, who are you talking to?
It's very tricky, yeah.
Who are you talking to? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's beautiful, man.
And it's totally possible. This is possible for people, for sure. I mean, I've seen people do this. I've seen people go through this. And it's happening more and more and more.
More, yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, dude. I really enjoyed this. I think there's three people in the audience who are going to be like, yeah, bro. And then 23,000 that are like,
that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
he said parking lot. Yeah. Right. Dude, thank you, Angela. So we'll put this out. So for people who want to go deeper on this stuff, Awake, It's Your Turn. That's Dr. DeLulo's book. We've done a series now. I'm going to link to it. It's all going to be kind of tied together, just like the universe, man. It's all dependent origination, whatever that is. And share the video. And there's no we. Just out.
There's not even out.
Peace.